This is Culturetopia, your weekly roundup of the very best arts and culture stories from NPR. I am Netta Ulaby, reporter for NPR's Arts Desk.
And I'm Tanya Ballard-Brown, an editor for NPR Digital News.
Just a reminder, you can, as always, subscribe to this podcast at npr.org/culturetopia. This week,
a look at a few new summer movies, including The A-Team.
We find out what it might actually cost to be a patient of TV doctor House of House MD.
And a profile of an understudy who's carrying the load of both lead roles in La Cage aux Folles. But first,
summer is usually a time when moviegoers look for escapism, not reality. But from now till Labor Day, they'll find theaters packed with documentaries. At least 21 by our count, 8 this month alone. Among them, Joan Rivers, A Piece of Work. Bob Mondello has our review.
The film opens with a lingering shot you probably don't expect. An enormous full-screen close-up of Joan Rivers without makeup. Veins spidery, skin blotchy, upper lip frozen, eyebrows so thin you can count every hair. It's a declaration of intent that this picture will not just be about surfaces. Then she slathers on foundation, lipstick, mascara thick as paste, and younger images start appearing as shadows, along with voices from her past.
Would you welcome Miss Joan Rivers? You know, you're going to be a big star.
Oh, here's my daffy little friend, Joan Rivers.
By the end of the accolades, she's fully made up, the Joan Rivers we know, ready to talk trash, but first having to wade through trash, down stairwells piled high with junk, to backstage hallways with peeling paint, onto a tiny, dilapidated stage.
My career. I mean, how depressing is this? 40 years in the business, and this is where you end up.
At 77, Rivers doesn't play Vegas as often as she once did, but there's still a Joan Rivers industry headquartered in her wildly Baroque Manhattan apartment. Gold, white, pink. This, she says, is how Marie Antoinette would have lived if she'd had money. In her office is a sort of joke museum, a wall of alphabetized card catalog drawers stuffed with 3x5 cards, each one typed neatly with a gag she's delivered, often to outrage, especially back in the days when female comics were expected to be demure.
You know how lousy you feel at night when I'm undressed, my husband looks at me and mentally dresses me? You know how
bad for me? When I started comedy, I was very wild for the time, but different times. The last line of my original act was, "This business, it's all about casting couches, so I just want you to know my name's Joan Rivers, and I put out." It's such a sweet little silly line from a girl who was 28 years old, you know, dressed up, trying to look nice. The audience, half of them laughed. Jack Lemmon saw me and walked out. Said, "That's disgusting." So for my time, I was very shocking.
Shocking played well as late night fare, of course, and for a time, Joan was the late night queen, anointed by the king himself.
Don't you think men really like intelligence more when it comes right down to it?
Ah, please, are we going to go back to that? Are you kidding?
Sure, I mean, it's a brain, you know, a caring person.
No man has ever put his hand up a woman's dress looking for a library card.
Rivers became Johnny Carson's designated replacement host, but when she took a late-night gig on a rival network, Carson never spoke to her again. Her show was a flop, her husband felt responsible and committed suicide, and her struggle to rebuild took decades. As the film repeatedly makes clear, comedy is a high-wire act where you're forever in danger of crashing.
Oh, I hate children. The only child that I think I would have liked ever was Helen Keller, because she didn't talk. And it's just... Yes, it is. And if you don't, then leave.
Funny if you have a deaf son.
I happen to have a deaf mother. Oh, you stupid. Let me tell you what comedy is.
How she gets the audience laughing again, I'll leave you to discover for yourself. Suffice it to say, she doesn't get any less abrasive or less self-absorbed. But as the film demonstrates, there is more to this particular hard-charging, egomaniacal joke machine than gets revealed on stage. Plastic surgery, vulgarity, red carpet chats, all just small pieces of Joan Rivers, A Piece of Work. I'm Bob Mondello.
That documentary might actually end up doing better than The A-Team, which opened this past weekend and doesn't survive the transition from semi-beloved 80s TV series to 21st century action movie. Morning Edition film critic Kenneth Turan has been watching the movie.
Overkill is underrated, a member of the A-Team says, but you wouldn't know it from this film. This big screen version of the hit TV series is overly long, overcomplicated, and overflowing with billions of bullets and boku broken glass. As TV star Mr. T might say, I pity the fool who mistakes this for genuine entertainment. Just like in the 1980s, we've got team leader Hannibal Smith.
It gets better.
Suave Lothario, face peck.
I'm living the dream. Man.
Crazed pilot, Howling Mad Murdoch.
Rotors are good, sir.
And the muscular BA for bad attitude, Baracus.
Oh, hell yeah.
The problem is not that these folks have been given too little to do, but too much. The story begins somewhere in Mexico, where bad guys are doing their worst in the hot desert sun. Before the credits are over, the four A-Team members have met via a series of improbable coincidences and discovered the virtues of working together.
I'm told you're a hell of a chopper pilot.
The best, sir.
I'm not getting on the chopper with this nut job, man.
Yeah, that's a good... You know, was he another one of your projects?
I'm a real soldier. I'm a ranger, baby.
The film then jumps 8 years and 80 successful missions later. Their next assignment involves going into Baghdad during the Iraq War and getting their hands on a... Oh, who cares?
Fire! Boom!
Watching this film feels like watching an extended trailer rather than a movie. An NFL highlights reel of cascading cars and exotic explosions. Writer-director Joe Carnahan was hired for the project because he's one of Hollywood's go-to guys for brisk, adrenalized action. And he delivers. Up to a point. He's also responsible for homilies like, stuff like loyalty doesn't fit in overhead bins. These may not be words to live by, but they're the best this undernourished A-Team can come up with.
You know, Tanya, our producer, Michael Katziff, was just mourning the absence of the actual Mr. T in this movie, which made me wonder what he's been up to. And I don't know, but I'm just hoping that Quentin Tarantino or someone finds him and revitalizes his career and casts him in something awesome.
I think he's been doing commercials or something. I've seen him around. He's still Mr. T.
And now we're going to go from the big screen to the small screen. If you turned on the Bravo Network about 15 years ago or so, you'd see high art. Ballet or operas. Now Bravo's all about glossy competition shows like Top Chef and a new series called Work of Art, The Next Great Artist. Think American Idol gone all art world. NPR's Elizabeth Blair reports the winner will get $100,000 and a show at the Brooklyn Museum.
The format is exactly like Top Chef and Project Runway. There's a group of contestants, in this case 14 very different artists, painters, video artists, photographers.
I spent a lot of time flipping burgers during the day and then in the afternoon shooting scantily clad models in weird costumes.
There's the mentor, the Tim Gunn figure from Project Runway. On Work of Art, it's Simone de Puri of the auction house Phillips de Puri & Company.
I'm very impressed in terms of processing. It's first rate and I hope that the result will be equally first rate.
Me too.
The artists have to create under a tight deadline.
You have until midnight tonight.
And the personalities clash.
That triangle painting, it's not so good.
Naya's really rude.
And at the end of each episode, somebody goes home. The producers who brought us Project Runway and Top Chef are also behind Work of Art. They say, if it ain't broke...
Maybe that's creatively unambitious, but this formula kind of works.
Dan Cutworth and his partner Jane Lipsitz say they're also sticking with the familiar because the art world could intimidate the audience.
You know, everyone felt that putting it against the backdrop of a familiar format was the way to make people feel comfortable.
I'm really into lilies, right?
Lilies.
And hermaphrodites.
The judges include an art critic and two gallery owners. The winning artist will have a show at the Brooklyn Museum.
And this is the gallery.
Brooklyn Museum Director for Art, Charles Demaray, shows off a smallish gallery where the winner's work will be displayed. He says he has no qualms about giving space, not far from American masters like Georgia O'Keeffe, to an artist whose claim to fame is winning a reality TV show.
I find it very much like the juried show. And the juried show was meant to introduce artists and to give artists opportunities that didn't go through the normal channels, and so that everybody could submit their work. So I don't know. I don't think it's all that different.
But there are some differences. In a juried show, the artists most likely haven't been filmed while they work, in the same room at the same time as their competitors, not to mention live together.
I've never stayed in a place like this. I've been sleeping in my truck and sleeping at my parents' house.
Whatever it is, these 14 young artists might get ahead quicker in their careers because of the exposure. At least that's what Andres Serrano thinks. Serrano is perhaps best known as one of the artists at the center of the culture wars of the 1980s. He's one of a handful of artists who appear on the new Bravo show.
No shocking work sometimes is not even meant to be shocking.
When the producers first asked Serrano to be on the TV show, he says he was a little skeptical.
Actually, I was surprised that I felt the show was good, and so I was pleasantly surprised. It was very meaningful.
He had only one concern.
I wanted to make sure that I looked good on camera, and I think I did, you know.
The winner of Bravo's new reality series, Work of Art, will have a show at the Brooklyn Museum right near a show by Andy Warhol. It's anyone's guess whether the winner's fame will last more than 15 minutes. Elizabeth Blair, NPR News.
For the last year or so, health insurance and the cost of American health care have dominated much of the news cycle. And if you happen to watch the Fox TV show HouseMD, you might wonder how much the treatments cost. Andrew Holtz did. This led him to write the book, The Medical Science of HouseMD, and the forthcoming book, HouseMD Versus Reality. Robert Siegel spoke with Holtz about the book and the cost of medicine on television.
And we asked you to think in particular about an episode of House that was called Ignorance is Bliss. Perhaps you could run us through some of the medical issues that arose in the case of the patient, one James Sidas.
Well, this patient showed up with some odd symptoms. They said he had ataxia, anemia, a mild cough. They started doing, as they always do in these episodes, a barrage of tests. And then they started throwing out all sorts of bizarre potential diagnoses. The more bizarre, the better.
Eventually, they're talking about something called TTP.
That's right, thrombotic thrombocytopenic purpura.
Schistocyte suggests TTP.
Good.
It's an important lesson of House. Anything that is believed to be true in the first half of the program can be dismissed as untrue.
That's right. Although sometimes in this show, they miss some obvious clues in order to prolong the drama and find out that it was something that any medical student should have figured out. And other times it is something that's just so rare that it's only been mentioned at most a handful of times in the entire history of medicine.
Turns out the patient is a drinker.
We found vodka stashed away in this place.
And it is proposed that they do a liver biopsy.
Taubman 13 can do the liver biopsy today.
Going to a hospital, liver biopsy?
Yeah, I found one estimate from one insurance company that estimated that a liver biopsy might cost somewhere between $8,000 and $11,000. So not petty change. One thing I found when I was looking at this, a lot of people said, well, we just don't know because it depends exactly which variety of the procedure we're doing, which institution we're doing it in, which insurer you have, whether the moon is in retrograde. It just seems that, as with anything else in healthcare, trying to nail down what seems like a simple question turns into an episode in Bizarro Land.
But the patient in this case collapses. He's sick. There's an MRI. Is there some obvious ballpark figure we could attach to what the MRI was?
An MRI could be anything from maybe a couple of $100 to $1,000. And again, it often depends on the deals that insurance companies make with a hospital. It's all a matter of negotiation.
And then there's a pretty serious procedure.
So that means we have to give him a splenectomy.
Yes, it does.
A splenectomy, I found one estimate in New Jersey, because that's where the show is set, found that a splenectomy often involves about 8 days in the hospital and a charge of about $140,000.
Wow. So that's the big one. And in this particular case, as you've noted to me, since the patient's spleen had broken up over the years, you could have called this multiple splenectomies.
Yeah, at the end of the episode, they find out that, yes, they'd taken out a spleen, the main spleen, but this patient had had an injury years before, broken a rib, which had punctured the spleen, and little spleens had grown up, accessory spleens, and they found 16 of them. So I don't know if you get bulk rate discount when you have 16 splenectomies all in one day.
Well, here's hoping that the idea of little splenectomies might leave you craving a little blue-eyed retro soul. Singer and songwriter Mayer Hawthorne shares what music is playing in his ear. Tell Me More recently spoke to Hawthorne a while back about his album, A Strange Arrangement. And here he is, telling us what music he uses to escape.
How do you do? This is Mayer Hawthorne, and I'm going to give you a little sneak peek in my iPod right now. A couple songs that I'm listening to right now. The first being from my favorite MC right now. His name is Buff One. That's a song called Real Appeal. It's just got everything that you want in a hip-hop song. It's hard beats, dope rhymes, everything. Cause I can see it, girl, and no denying that you want it right now from me. There's something about you, girl, that's got me curious and thinking about you. But I'm just playing it cool, I'm trying to see if you gon' make the first move. Since I've started working on this Mayer Hawthorne project, I've been listening to a ton of Motown and the Marvelettes. As Long As I Know He's Mine stays in constant rotation. There may be clouds in the sky, but even if it starts to rain, my days are bright as can be. Oh, you don't catch me complaining. You know, the Marvelettes are probably my favorite Motown act, mostly because their songs are generally a little strange, sort of like mine. You know, they don't follow your typical pop structures or, you know, chord progressions. I like the catchy stuff, but also the stuff that's a little weird. The third song that I'm really listening to right now, well, I love everything from this Norwegian singer-songwriter named Hannah Hukelberg. I'm totally obsessed with her right now. Her songwriting is absolutely beautiful, but also very bizarre. I guess if you want a starting point, I would start with a song called Do Not As I Do. From there, you'll be totally hooked.
Here's a tongue twister. Hannah Hukelberg and La Cage aux Folles. The oldest cliche in show business may be the show must go on. For a special breed of Broadway actors, the understudies, it's their job. Jeff London spoke with three understudies who cover roles for actors who were nominated for the Tonys.
The revival of Promises, Promises, a splashy 1960s musical, stars Sean Hayes and Kristen Chenoweth. But keep your eyes peeled for Megan Sikora. She's not just in the chorus.
It's turkey lurkey time. Tom Turkey ran away, but he just came home.
I play Miss Polanski, who is the turkey lurkey girl in the green dress. I play Sylvia, and I play a very angry nurse and, you know, dancer here and there.
As if that weren't enough, she understudies Kristen Chenoweth and Katie Finneran. Finneran's the odds-on favorite to win Best Featured Actress in a Musical for her loopy portrayal of a drunken barfly named Marge.
Because it's Christmas, not a time to be alone with memory.
With all her different roles, Megan Sikora barely has any downtime during a performance.
I'm on stage a lot, which makes it difficult to watch the ladies that I understudy and pay attention, because it's my responsibility as an understudy to know their job, to know the ins and outs of their job, so that if I got thrown on, Sean Hayes would not be, I wouldn't rock his boat by doing something dramatically different.
Sikora says she sometimes sneaks a peek from the corner of her eye on stage, but a lot of her work happens on Thursday and Friday afternoons at understudy rehearsals.
All the understudies and swings get together, and we have play practice, basically. That's what we like to call it. And it's our chance to physicalize it and figure it out and say everything out loud and have other actors saying it to you and really find your version of it, because I don't think anybody wants to see an understudy go on and just do a poor imitation of what they would have seen.
So imagine what it must be like to understudy both Tony-nominated stars of the Tony-nominated revival of La Cage aux Folles, Kelsey Grammer and Douglas Hodge. That's Chris Hoke's job.
I said I cover them both, Kelsey and Doug, but Doug's is the more terrifying. Not only the parameters of the role itself, but just his performance, too, is just so outside the box. So you have to give a flavor of that, and it's absolutely terrifying. I wake up every morning and I pray for his health.
I am what I am, and what I am leaves no excuses.
Most Broadway insiders consider Douglas Hodge a lock to win the Tony for Best Leading Actor in a Musical, playing the fluttery drag performer Albin. In one number, Albin literally applies makeup and gets dressed in front of the audience. Understudy Chris Hoke says to prepare himself, he's not only memorized the lines and the staging, he's gone to transsexual websites and, during off hours, descends the four flights of stairs from his dressing room to get comfortable walking in high heels on stage.
I mean, it's funny. I go down every once in a while and just walk around in the heels. Wearing them well is a totally different... It's a totally different ball of wax.
Hoke has understudied in several Broadway shows and is well aware that he may never get the call to step into Douglas Hodge's pumps. Hoke says actors shouldn't take the job expecting the lead actor to get sick and to become a star themselves.
Well, I think if you think of your time to go on as, this is my time to shine, and this is my big break, you know, and an Eve Harrington moment is always... I think, frowned upon by the company, for good reason. I mean, you have a big responsibility to your fellow actors when you do it, more so than you do to yourself.
For NPR News, I'm Jeff London in New York.
And for those who might have missed it, Douglas Hodge, one of the leads that Chris Hoke served as understudy for, did, in fact, end up winning the Tony this past weekend for his role in La Cage aux Folles.
Legendary comedian Tim Conway is on tour with a stage show this summer. At 78, he still looks a bit like a bank clerk. Short, bald, bespectacled, but concealing a famously incendiary wit. His career stretches from 1960 sitcoms, a dozen Disney movies, over a decade on The Carol Burnett Show, to his sixth Emmy for a guest shot on 30 Rock just last year, and he was the voice of Barnacle Boy on SpongeBob SquarePants. Scott Simon interviewed Tim Conway at a recent taping of the PBS TV series Backstage With.
I guess I was destined to do this. People have often said, you know, what else would you do if you weren't doing this? And the answer is nothing, because I'm not capable of doing anything else. This is pretty much it.
Were your parents funny?
My parents were very funny. They didn't know it, but they were. They were actually sharing an IQ. They just did humorous things that, well, for instance, my dad put in a doorbell one time, and he put it in backwards so that it rang all the time, except when you pressed the doorbell. You'd sit at home at night, and you'd hear this, and when it would stop, my dad would go, I'll get it. So you grow up with that kind of attitude, and I think you're bound to find the humor in there somewhere.
Did you make people laugh at school?
Well, I was dyslexic. Still am. Because I would see words that weren't there, and people just started laughing, and I thought, well, this is a good way to make a living. I'll just go downtown and read and have people laugh. You know.
You discovered you could make people laugh. But
yes.
But it was almost to cover up some embarrassment.
That's a good idea. Wish I'd have thought of that. No, that's true. I guess I was really kind of the class clown, because when you're small, you either are funny or you get beat up a lot.
So are certain things funny, certain words clever or witty, or are people funny?
I enjoy being funny and kind of not shock value, not language-wise. Well, for instance, I was in a department store out in Los Angeles, and I was in the men's department. I was leaning against the counter, and evidently a lady thought that I was working there. So she came up to me and she said, excuse me, where is your underwear? So So I showed her. So she calls the store manager. I go, hey, listen, what is this guy? I said, she asked me where my underwear was. I showed her. You know. It's that kind of harmless humor I really enjoy.
I love Tim Conway. I love him. I love him.
You can hear the full interview at npr.org/culturetopia. That's it for this week.
You can find links to all the stories we have today and subscribe to this podcast at npr.org/culturetopia. I'm Tanya Ballard-Brown.
And I am Netta Ulibi. Thanks for listening to Culturetopia. So long.